From NPR News, this is special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Just shy of noon today, before a National Mall packed with many hundreds of thousands of flag-waving supporters, the nation's first black president was sworn in to a second term. On this holiday celebrating Martin Luther King Jr., the president placed his left hand on two Bibles, one once owned by Mr. King, the other used by President Abraham Lincoln for his first inauguration in 1861. Chief Justice John Roberts led the oath.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
During the ceremony, New York Senator Chuck Schumer served as master of ceremonies. He spoke of Lincoln and Americans' capacity to overcome divisions. He then introduced Marilee Evers Williams, widow of slain civil rights leader Medgar Evers. Evers Williams is the first woman and layperson to give the inaugural invocation. Let's listen to some of that, and we'll also hear the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir, Vice President Joe Biden taking his oath from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor and singer James Taylor.
We now stand beneath the shadow of the nation's capital, whose golden dome reflects the unity and democracy of one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Approximately 4 miles from where we are assembled, the hallowed remains of men and women rest in Arlington Cemetery. They who believed, fought, and died for this country.
Mr. Vice President, please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Joseph R. Biden, Jr., do solemnly swear.
I, Joseph R. Biden, Jr., do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies,
purple mountain majesties. Above the fruited plain.
Then it was President Obama's turn to take the oath, followed by trumpets, the U.S. Marine Band playing Hail to the Chief, and a 21-gun salute. President Obama's address was just under 20 minutes, and we'll hear parts of it coming up. But first, excerpts from the last part of today's ceremony, poet Richard Blanco, Reverend Dr. Luis Leon giving the benediction, and performer Beyoncé closing out the event.
Many prayers, but one light. Breathing color into stained glass windows, life into the faces of bronze statues, warmth onto the steps of our museums and park benches as mothers watch children slide into the day. One ground, our ground, rooting us to every stalk of corn, every head of wheat sown by sweat and hands. Hands gleaning coal,
privileged to be citizens and residents of this nation, with a spirit of gratitude and humility, that we may become a blessing among the nations of this world. We pray that you will shower with your life-giving spirit the elected leaders of this land, especially Barack, our president, and Joe, our vice president. Fill them with the love of truth and righteousness, that they may serve this nation ably and be glad to do your will.
Oh,
After his oath, President Obama delivered a speech that was both more upbeat and more pointed than 4 years ago. He got right at one of the divisive debates that's marked his first term, the role of government, saying Americans have always vowed to move forward together.
Through it all, we have never relinquished our skepticism of central authority, nor have we succumbed to the fiction that all society's ills can be cured through government alone. Our celebration of initiative and enterprise, our insistence on hard work and personal responsibility, these are constants in our character. But we have always understood that when times change, so must we. That fidelity to our founding principles requires new responses to new challenges. That preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action. For the American people can no more meet the demands of today's world by acting alone than American soldiers could have met the forces of fascism or communism with muskets and militias. No single person can train all the math and science teachers we'll need to equip our children for the future, or build the roads and networks and research labs that will bring new jobs and businesses to our shores. Now, more than ever, we must do these things together, as one nation and one people.
And we're joined now by NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, national political correspondents Mara Liasson and Don Gagne, and legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Welcome all.
Here. Good to be here.
Nice to be here.
Don, you were out there on the Mall this morning. Give us a sense of the atmosphere.
It was not as cold as 4 years ago, I can tell you that.
For which you
were
thankful.
Some of us are thankful of that. That exactly. Listen, it was a smaller crowd. The crowd was maybe a third or so what it was 4 years ago, but it was still pretty electric out there. And I talked to a lot of people who couldn't make it 4 years ago. And they were really glad to see what was, again, obviously a very historic day and a chance to witness it in person. I talked to a lot of people who had been here 4 years ago, and they had a little bit of the sense of, yeah, we've done this before. We kind of know the deal. But they also had a sense of validation. It's like, you guys said we wouldn't be back, and here we are. So you picked up a lot of that. There was a lot of hope. There's that word. But there was also some sense that they know what it takes now. They're glad their guy's going to be in the White House the next 4 years, but they're bracing for what it'll be a pretty tough 4 years, they think.
Hmm. Ron, what struck you?
Well, I've seen a few of these over the years, and this one was, I think, remarkable for the symbols of change. Now, the president gave a highly poetic speech that contained a lot of echoes from voices of the past. Of course, some from Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address in 1865, some from Martin Luther King's famous rhetoric. But there were also a number of things about it that signaled who won the election. For example, we heard a great deal more from Hispanics. We heard a good deal more Spanish than I've heard in an inauguration before. I also heard a reference from the President of the United States to the rights of gay people, men and women, and to their right to marry and love whom they wished. I've never heard that at a presidential inauguration before, including President Obama's own first.
Hmm. Mara Liasson, 4 years ago, I went back at the 2009 speech, and it was a reminder of the crisis the nation was feeling, the financial crisis. A different tone this year.
Yes, you know, it's funny. 4 years ago, what we remember now is the incredible euphoria and the crowds, and it was a historic event. But the country was facing a terrible crisis, and the president had to deal with that first right off the bat. Now, that's behind him. You could tell that he was pretty happy today. He's not dealing with the plate of incredibly difficult problems that he had to do when he was first elected. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be easy to get his agenda through. Politics, I think, look as broken as they ever have in Washington. But it is a different tone. I think it's a tone of relief.
Nina Totenberg, what struck you?
Well, I think what struck me is the same thing that struck Ron. The remarkable participation this time of Hispanics and gay people and the conversation about gay people in the presidential inaugural. And the poet who gave his recitation, he's Cuban-American and gay. And So that's really what struck me.
There was a lesbian and gay band in the parade this afternoon, I noticed.
It just struck me as so, we have come so fast, so far, particularly the issue of gay rights. And Latinos, for the first time, made a huge difference, made their mark in an election. And both those things were so obvious today, and they never have been so obvious before.
Well, and Mr. Obama himself just last year announced that he had evolved to support gay marriage. So I don't know if this would have happened even 2 years ago, perhaps.
Maybe not.
We will have much more of President Obama's inaugural speech coming up. Stay with us. I'm Jennifer Ludden. This is special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration. Balls are about to start this evening. We've had a couple hours of marching bands down Pennsylvania Avenue, all the pomp and circumstance that comes with the occasion, dating back many, many generations. So a blend of tradition and, as we've been hearing, lots of new things as well added into the president's speech today, the events, modern tradition blending with some old traditions here in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. Stay with us. Special coverage of the second inauguration from NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. Just a few minutes before noon, standing at the west front of the Capitol building, President Obama delivered the first speech of his second term. He invoked themes of national unity, equality of opportunity, and the role of government. Preserving individual freedoms, he said, requires collective action. Let's listen now to extended excerpts from the president earlier today, speaking before hundreds of thousands on the National Mall.
We, the people, still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity. We must make the hard choices to reduce the cost of health care and the size of our deficit. But we reject the belief that America must choose between caring for the generation that built this country and investing in the generation that will build its future. For we remember the lessons of our past, when twilight years were spent in poverty, and parents of a child with a disability had nowhere to turn. We do not believe that in this country freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. We recognize that no matter how responsibly we live our lives, any one of us, at any time, may face a job loss or a sudden illness, or a home swept away in a terrible storm. The commitments we make to each other, through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. These things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. We, the people, still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult. But America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it. We cannot cede to other nations the technology that will power new jobs and new industries. We must claim its promise. That's how we will maintain our economic vitality and our national treasure. Our forests and waterways, our croplands and snow-capped peaks. That is how we will preserve our planet, commanded to our care by God. That's what will lend meaning to the creed our fathers once declared. We, the people, still believe that enduring security and lasting peace do not require perpetual war. Our brave men and women in uniform, tempered by the flames of battle, are unmatched in skill and courage. Our citizens, seared by the memory of those we have lost, know too well the price that is paid for liberty. The knowledge of their sacrifice will keep us forever vigilant against those who would do us harm. But we are also heirs to those who won the peace and not just the war, who turned sworn enemies into the surest of friends, and we must carry those lessons into this time as well.
President Obama also used this holiday to honor the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., linking his efforts 5 decades ago to a broader range of civil rights today.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth. It is now our generation's task to carry on what those pioneers began. For our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts. Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. Our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country. Our journey is not complete until all our children, from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia to the quiet lanes of Newtown, know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm. That is our generation's task, to make these words, these rights, these values of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness real for every American. Being true to our founding documents does not require us to agree on every contour of life. It does not mean we all define liberty in exactly the same way or follow the same precise path to happiness. Progress does not compel us to settle centuries-long debates about the role of government for all time, but it does require us to act in our time.
And finally, the president called for political action despite partisan differences.
For now, decisions are upon us, and we cannot afford delay. We cannot mistake absolutism for principle, or substitute spectacle for politics, or treat name-calling as reasoned debate. We must act. We must act knowing that our work will be imperfect. We must act knowing that today's victories will be only partial, and that it will be up to those who stand here in 4 years, and 40 years, and 400 years hence to advance the timeless spirit once conferred to us in a spare Philadelphia hall. My fellow Americans, the oath I have sworn before you today, like the one recited by others who serve in this Capitol, was an oath to God and country, not party or faction. And we must faithfully execute that pledge during the duration of our service. But the words I spoke today are not so different from the oath that is taken each time a soldier signs up for duty, or an immigrant realizes her dream. My oath is not so different from the pledge we all make to the flag that waves above and that fills our hearts with pride. They are the words of citizens, and they represent our greatest hope.
Extended excerpts from President Obama today in his second inaugural speech. I'm joined now in the studio by NPR political correspondents Mara Liasson and Don Gagne, our senior Washington editor Ron Elving, and legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Ron, we heard calls for unity, but the speech also has some pretty forceful challenges to Republicans in it.
That's right, a theme of harmony. But if you are listening to this speech with the ears of a conservative American, I suspect you heard some rather discordant notes, one of which we heard in just this last or the next to last excerpt. This sentence, I think, is going to come back a number of times. Progress does not compel us to settle centuries-long debates about the role of government for all time, but it does require us to act in our time. Well, that centuries-long debate about the role of government is important to American conservatives, and they want to settle it, not necessarily for all time, but they do want to settle it in a more, in a way that comports more with their values. In other words, they want to reduce the role of the federal government, and they did not hear a commitment to that in this speech today. And when the president says it requires us to act in our time, he means to act as a government, to do things, to do more things. And essentially what he is saying is, for now, let's do it my way, and maybe later on we can go back to this argument about the role of government.
Well, and of course, the budget is going to be a big player in all this. Mara, a lot about the role of government and a clear defense of Medicaid, Medicare, he mentioned. I mean, how do you read? Was there a balance in trying to reach out to Republicans and stake out some red lines, or where did you come down?
Well, I heard the president staking out some red lines. He really does have a different approach this term. I think he's learned a little bit about negotiating, which is that compromise is what you do at the end of the negotiation instead of at the beginning. And I think in the first term, he was busy telling people, well, I'm willing to meet you in the middle, and I'm willing to be reasonable, and I'm sure you'll be reasonable, too. Didn't work out so well. Now what he did, what he's going to do going forward, is what he did on the fiscal cliff. He lays down his maximalist bid to start with, and in the end, he does compromise. But you got to start somewhere. And he's saying that I'm going to start somewhere on Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. I don't believe that people who need them are takers. And then the rest of the people are makers, which is a standard Republican formulation. It wasn't only Mitt Romney. And I'll fight you on that. But I am willing to make the hard choices, he said, to reduce the cost of health care and the size of our deficit. Now, it was only a glancing reference to reducing the deficit. It was just a nod. But he has said over and over again, I have a deal on the table that I gave to John Boehner. The Republicans couldn't take it. But I think that he has a whole new approach here. He feels he won. He has more clout. He's going to lay out what he wants. He's going to fight them tooth and nail. And in the end, he hopes to come to an agreement.
Did you hear that, Nina? A different political approach this year.
Yeah, I think this is a little bit low down, but Barack Obama started out in his first term saying to the car dealer, essentially, well, what do you want for the car? And this time he starts out saying, I'll tell you what, I'm not paying for this car. I am not paying this for the car. Well, everybody knows, at least in a reasonable world, we hope, they will come to buying the car or paying something for the car, and a negotiation that leads to a mercantile deal. But he's trying a complete, it does appear that he's trying a very different approach this time.
Well, he is one of the few Democrats to be reelected. Two majority popular votes, correct?
That
I mean,
is
it's
correct.
Been a while since that happened.
Well, LBJ got a huge landslide in 1964, but otherwise, if you want to find a Democrat who won an outright majority, over 50% of the vote, you have to go all the way back to FDR.
Wow. Don Gagne, the man among the people today. How did his speech comport with what you were hearing for people's hopes and dreams here?
People liked the speech. This is the Democratic coalition out there in the mall. It's one thing to show up at a campaign rally in Iowa or New Hampshire or Columbus, Ohio. Went to a lot of those. But it's another thing to come all the way to Washington to see the guy you love be sworn in. But again, it is the Democratic coalition. So you get people who want to talk about immigration first, and you get people who want to talk about jobs first, and you get people who want to talk about gun control first, and you get people who just want him to take it to the Republicans, whatever that means, and really stick it to those guys because they're on the brink of total collapse. You just got to push them over the edge. So everybody's got their issue. But the thing that you do sense is people do think this is going to be very, very hard work.
Ron, speaking of gun control, immigration, I mean, it's the second term. Things are rolling. He's already got things in the works. We now have he recently presented his package of proposals for gun control since the election. Lots of talk from both parties on getting an immigration deal. I was surprised we did not hear much on those. They were little lines. There was a lot on climate change, an issue that just recently resurfaced in the political debate.
That's right. He's going to climate change a little bit more because we haven't talked about it that much. But if you want details on all of the above, stay tuned. 3 weeks from tonight, or excuse me, 3 weeks from tomorrow night on February 12th, that Tuesday, the president will come before a joint session of Congress. It will be quite a lively session. I suspect we will hear a lot of emotional outpouring from the Democrats, and I suspect we'll hear a lot of emotional outpouring from some Republicans as well. And he's going to lay out a much more programmatic approach. It'll be approximately 3.5 times or 4 times as long a speech as this one was. And we'll hear all the programmatic detail we're likely to hear from Barack Obama. Then the rest of it will come in the budget that he submits, and we'll have at it. There are lots of occasions in just the weeks ahead for the president to go at it with the Republicans.
Mara Liasson, there was some, but national security, foreign policy, not nearly as much as we had 4 years ago. What did you hear on these subjects today?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's this piece of conventional wisdom where, say, second-term presidents often turn abroad because they are lame ducks at home and they can more readily control and affect events abroad, which is almost laughable when you think about the situation now. He can't control anything overseas at all. So I actually think that his approach is to have us be, as he put it, the anchor, but not the main player around the world. And he says, you know, that we don't have to have perpetual war in order to keep the peace. He's moving to a light footprint. He's nominated people who agree with him on that, winding down the war in Afghanistan. He's finished the war, he would say, in Iraq. He's moving to kind of hands-off type of interventions like drones, where you don't have boots on the ground, you just have, you know, assassination raining down from the sky. And that's the approach he's going to take. Now, he can't control the things that happen. There's Iran and North Korea and the Middle East and the Arab Spring and all the al-Qaeda affiliates in Northern Africa. And that's going to be, I think that will dominate a lot of his second term, but we don't know exactly what crisis there will be.
Right, and we've just seen a crisis, Tangani, playing out in Algeria. No one would have predicted that. Islamic insurgents in Mali. Is this something that will... are there any plans he has for this region, or he's just kind of dealing as he goes?
I think they have been watching the region, and they've been looking for opportunities, and they do want to try to do some things. But, you know, foreign policy, it's that old saying, you know, stuff happens, which isn't quite the old saying. But it's... Yeah.
But 4 years ago, there was an outreach speech in, yes, in Cairo, outreach to the Arab world. I'm not hearing so much this time.
No, you've got him, dealing with Iran. You've got him managing the... end of Afghanistan and Iraq wars. There's certainly Pakistan that is still something that has to be a big, scary part of his daily briefing every day. We are not hearing anything, any of those kind of big, kind of thematic kind of speeches like he gave in Cairo very early in that first year.
But Ron Elving, briefly, I guess we will in 3 weeks at the State of the Union?
That's correct, and we will hear much more on those fronts. But I think in the first term, the president, in that very first year, thought he was going to be an international rock star, and I think in the long run that probably hurt him in terms of his domestic agenda and was a distraction and undercut to some degree his ability to get what he wanted at home.
Well, you know, second-term presidents have learned in the first 4 years that there are these locusts, as they've called them in this administration, things you can never anticipate, from BP to Benghazi.
They swoop in and then you react. Okay, I'm Jennifer Ludden. This is special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration. We'll continue in just a few moments. Stay with us. This is NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration. I'm Jennifer Ludden. After his swearing-in, President Obama led the traditional parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. He then settled into a reviewing stand where the first daughters snapped family photos and they all watched the rest of the procession. This is the president's alma mater, the Punahou High School Marching Band from Honolulu. There were dozens of other bands, honor guards, and drill teams. One that especially had the first couple bopping along, the Isisarets Drill and Drum Corps of Des Moines, Iowa. And through it all, Mr. Obama smiled, waved, and chewed gum, widely suspected to be Nicorette. Nina Totenberg, this is just the most public part of a whole weekend full of events, exhausting events, I'm sure.
Well, nobody probably is more exhausted at the end of it all than the president and the vice president and their spouses and families, because they're on all the time. But if you drive through downtown Washington yesterday, today, probably even tomorrow. It's Gridlock City. You hear sirens. We're right across from the convention center where the balls are already, I don't know about in full swing, but in swing. And you can hear sirens all the time. There are jersey walls up everywhere. There are, it's quite an amazing event. And as we sit here this evening, we have the TV on, I confess, because once we get a look at the ball gown, if we get a look at the ball gown, we'll tell you what it looks like, folks. As it is, people went shallow today and talked about the bangs and the coat and
the eyelashes.
We'll go live to the gown if we
and
do get
the boots.
A shot of the gown.
We'll break in.
And the boots.
That's
and the change of
shallow.
Shoes. And the change of shoes. And the change of shoes.
Oh,
yeah, Mara and I are really
red. Not
forget you guys.
All.
The three of you know, the three of us,
purple.
Jennifer
purple Mar- was the Obama women's theme.
Okay, bye, guys.
We just want to see what Joe Biden is up to tonight.
All right.
He stole the show in
However,
the parade.
Obama's grandmother would have told him to just stuff the Nicorette. You're president of the United States. You do not chew gum.
It was constant every time I looked. Well, guess he can do what he wants now. He's been reelected. Okay, but after all these celebrations, it will be back to business. Don Gagne, I imagine no one's being too critical today, but have you had a sense of what the Republican reaction is, or what do you expect it to be?
It will get worse as time goes on. But today it's been mostly polite, but I did see a John McCain tweet that said the president never mentioned working with the opposition in his speech today. Some of the blogosphere, obviously, has been more harsh and much stronger about the role of government and how we didn't tackle this and that. But, mostly today there were a lot of congratulations on a second term, from Eric Cantor and from others. I saw congratulations to Chuck Schumer for running such a good show up there today. So it's been, it's been polite today. But tune in tomorrow morning.
It doesn't take long.
Or later tonight.
Or later tonight, yeah.
Well, we've just had Ron Elving a concession of sorts, I guess, from Republican leaders on the debt ceiling. Tell us about that.
In the House, they are planning to raise the debt ceiling just enough to get us to April 15th. That's a date that, of course, is close to the hearts of many conservatives and many Republicans. That's tax day. And they also have said that they're not going to let the debt ceiling rise any further than April 15th until the Senate passes a budget. Now, this is kind of a little bit of inside baseball. I'm not sure on Inauguration Day a lot of people want to talk about it. But the Senate has not passed a budget in 4 years. The Senate really doesn't have regular order anymore to a large degree. Things have broken down in both chambers to a large degree. But the House Republicans are particularly upset that the Senate Democrats, where the Democrats are still in majority control, have not passed a budget that they can sit down and deal with and contrast with their own budgets. So their House Budget Chairman, Paul Ryan, has come forward and said, this is our ultimatum. You guys pass a budget we can negotiate with, and we'll raise the debt ceiling just long enough for you to do it. But if you don't do it, no more debt ceiling increases. Then we hit the wall.
That doesn't sound as concession-oriented as I thought. Mara Liasson, what's the significance of this?
Well, one of the significances is that if they go to April 15th, that means that they go beyond the two other deadlines that we're dealing with, the two other cliffs. One is the sequester, the automatic spending cuts that would happen because of the last deal that the Congress and the White House made that kicked the can down the road. Also, the government shutdown, because the House and Senate haven't passed budgets. They've been operating the government by something called a continuing resolution, which is a kind of stopgap funding measure. That also runs out sometime in March, so the government would theoretically shut down. So you've got these two other deadlines. Presumably, what you could do, and the president has said he is willing to negotiate about cutting the deficit in regard to these other two deadlines, the sequester and the government shutdown, but not the debt ceiling. So then you could have these negotiations around these other two things, and it wouldn't look like you're negotiating on the debt ceiling, but in fact, the debt ceiling clock is ticking once again. But I do think one thing that was significant is after the House Republicans came up with their new approach, which is, okay, Senate, you have to pass a budget or else we're going to dock your pay, and
that's how, what we're going to tie the debt ceiling to. Chuck Schumer said, well, we were going to pass a budget anyway. We haven't done one in years, but we are ready to do it now. We're going to return to regular order, which would be shocking in Washington. Regular order is when things actually march through committees and subcommittees, and then the two houses pass them, and then they get together and reconcile them. And Chuck Schumer said, well, we want to do that because when you do it that way, you go through the process called reconciliation. You only need 50 votes for things instead of 60, or you need 51 votes. So they're hoping to start an actual process of deficit reduction and tax reform through the reconciliation process of the budget. So now we'll see if that actually happens, but that would be a welcome change. Regular order, that's the way things are supposed to work. Fight it out, vote on things, and then compromise.
So this could be read as sort of a willingness on either side to kind of try and work together.
Try to start off the way you're supposed to work.
It certainly could. In addition to the fact that I think as the Republicans went to their retreat, they really were getting leaned on, not only by some in their own party. They had a real rift within their own party about whether they really wanted to call the White House's bluff on the deficit and possibly face another reduction in our bond ratings. But they were hearing from the business community, including small business. And it just was going to be, I think that it suddenly dawned on the majority of the Republican caucus that this was not a fight they wanted to have, at least right now.
Don Gagne, anything else that struck you coming out of this recent Republican meeting among Republican leaders?
It does show, at least, you know, that big spark of recognition that the world as they thought they knew it after 2010 is not the world today. Again, John Boehner still has that very kind of restive wing within his party. It's a smaller Tea Party group, but it still is this hardcore group, and he has to keep an eye on them. But that's, I guess, that's my basic take on that.
Nina, in the speech today, as Ron was saying earlier, the president referred to same-sex marriage, a first, we believe, in an inaugural speech, something he just announced his support for last year. He said, "Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law," an issue, in fact, that will come up before the Supreme Court this year.
In two cases, one involves the Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed, was passed by overwhelming majorities in 1996, bipartisan majorities in the House and Senate, signed by President Clinton into law enthusiastically. And now the court is to consider whether that law is unconstitutional, whether it treats legally married gay couples unconstitutionally differently from legally married heterosexual couples. In this case, it involves an estate tax, whether a gay couple who, a lesbian couple where the one partner dies, whether the remaining spouse has to pay $350,000 in taxes she wouldn't have to pay otherwise if she were heterosexual, if she were married to a man. The other case is from California Prop 8 and involves whether or not there's a constitutional right to gay marriage. Personally, I'd be surprised if the Supreme Court went that far, but that case has a lot of highways and byways and other ways it can go. The Defense of Marriage Act, I think, is much. If you were a betting person, you would say the odds favor the gay rights point of view. Hmm. But it's close. It's probably going to be 5-4.
And politically, Ron Elving, how meaningful will this be for Mr. Obama, whatever else he hopes to do in his term? I mean, it's not like the health care law, but I suppose, but still, this is something he's staked his political views on.
It creates a certain atmosphere to have the Supreme Court knocking down everything you do or everything you favor. It creates quite another atmosphere to have the Supreme Court in any sense endorsing it. For example, with the health care law a year ago, that was really touch and go, and it appears that the main justification that the administration was looking for, the Commerce Clause, was rejected by the court, and yet the court upheld the law in the end, and so we have Obamacare. And so Obamacare is the law of the land, and that wound up to some degree redounding to his benefit politically in getting him reelected. You can argue that if he had seen that law struck down by the Supreme Court, it would have hurt him. in his image as president running for re-election. You can also argue that it would have galvanized some of his supporters. In the end, it appears his supporters were pretty well galvanized. And so, on balance, perhaps it was a big benefit for him that Obamacare was upheld. Now, when we look at these other cases, the president is not running for re-election, of course, but the Democrats are looking to 2014 right now. And having DOMA upheld, I don't think would be a great help to the Democrats. I think having it overturned, if the court agrees that we have moved into a new age of acceptance with respect to gay marriage and moves the country in that direction, that will certainly upset a lot of people, no question. But it will probably, in the long run, confirm in the minds of the Democrats that this is the right direction and that they're on the side of the future.
But if it's overturned, would you still see all the state activism around this that we have that's propelled Republicans to the polls and so forth?
You still would. I think it's something like two-thirds of the states now have, or 40%, I'm not sure. I think maybe it's 30 states now have constitutional amendments banning gay marriage. So undoing those constitutional amendments, it's different in every state, but it's much different than simply saying, okay, we're going to change our mind and pass a different law. It's much more difficult, and therefore the number of states is going to grow where gay marriage is legal. That's clear. But how far it can grow and how fast remains uncertain. And for those places where it is now legal, the DOMA case, the Defense of Marriage Act case, involves, okay, you're legally married in the state of New York or Massachusetts or California or Iowa, but you don't have the same rights to benefits under the federal law. So you don't have the same rights to Social Security survivors' benefits. There are literally something like 1,000 statutes that give some sort of benefits to the spouse of an individual. And if you don't get that benefit, you're in a definitely belittled situation. I'm not saying it's unconstitutional. It's a lesser position, though. You can't deny it's a lesser position. And so this is a question not only of gay rights, it's a question of states' rights, too, because these states have decided that they're going to do this. And this is a state-federal issue. But I just want to say one other thing. That's this year's case. What we see repeatedly in the course of American history, unless president is very lucky or is president like FDR was for a very long time, four terms or most, and three and a half terms, it is the nominees of the previous presidents who determine whether your agenda is constitutional, is legal, is upheld. And at the moment, the court is a very conservative court. It's more conservative than any court in the last probably 50 years. And that is the court that's going to determine whether Barack Obama's agenda, whether it's on climate change, whether it's on contraception and the ACA now, that's one wrinkle of the ACA, whether it's on Dodd-Frank and the regulations under the that were enacted after the crash, whether any or all or part or which part of those that legislative agenda is upheld, in the last analysis, will be up to the Supreme Court and most likely to the nominees of his predecessors.
Well, now, he did get two Supreme Court picks his first term. Not that it changed that balance, but do we expect any in the next term, I guess?
You never know. If we do, they're most likely, actuarially, they're most likely to be either Justice Ginsburg, who's the oldest member of the court, she'll be 80 in March, or Justice Breyer, who's 74. For a conservative, the most likely conservative to retire, if we're talking actuarial tables, is Justice Scalia. He doesn't look to me like he's going anywhere.
The cabinet is in flux now. Ron Elving, lots of changes. Can you bring us up to date? Who's gone, who's replacing them, and who else might leave?
We can hit the high points. John Kerry is going to replace Hillary Clinton at the Department of State. That nomination is very much on track. Chuck Hagel has been nominated to replace Leon Panetta at the as Secretary of Defense. That's a rockier situation, but with the Democrats lining up behind Hagel now, it looks as though the Republicans are not going to filibuster or block that nomination. So while he may have a number of votes against him, a large number of votes against him, it appears that he will be confirmed. Jack Lew, who's been the President's Chief of Staff, is going to replace Tim Geithner at the Treasury Department. That, too, will be controversial, and a lot of the Republicans will want to give speeches and vote against him. But in the end, it appears pretty likely he'll be confirmed. Eric Holder is holding in place at Justice. We don't expect to get a new Attorney General right away, although whether or not he serves the whole next 4 years is probably problematic. Janet Napolitano at Homeland Security is staying in place. She would very much like to be the next Attorney General should Mr. Holder move on. Ken Salazar is leaving at Interior, Hilda Solis leaving at Labor, Lisa Jackson leaving at Environment and Public Works, and we expect Stephen Chu probably to leave the Department of Energy as well, and the successors in those four cases are not yet clear.
Is that an unusual amount of turnover, or is this normal?
This is really only about half the cabinet that I've run through. There are lots more people, some of whom might leave before the next 4 years are up, but those are the highlights in terms of the exits and the replacements.
Could I ask you a question, Ron? I'm wondering, do you think that we have an unusually strong opposition, not necessarily successful, but opposition to presidents' choices this time? Normally, my recollection is somebody has to be really kind of offensive to the minority party for some. The losing party in the presidential election, in order for them, their standard bearers to say, not this one. But it seems to me that that's just happened with an unusual number. Even Jack Lew, even before he was nominated, I got in my email a boomlet bomblet from Senator Jeff Sessions, the chairman of the Budget Committee, saying, no way, no how, Jose.
Jeff Sessions has a particular problem with Jack Lew because they have negotiated in the past, and Jack Lew has said things to Jeff Sessions which he believes were not entirely forthcoming or truthful, so we're going to have some struggle over that. But by and large, we have seen in the past guys like John Ashcroft, who had been a senator himself. There were 40-some votes against him when he became attorney general. But usually it focuses on one or two. Yeah. If there's something unusual about now, it's that it's become the rule that if you've got any problem with the person at all, you make a big fuss about it, even if you can't ultimately keep them from getting the job.
All right. We're still waiting to see the inaugural ball gown. But meanwhile, Mara, in the brief moment we have left, anything you heard today that informs you on what to expect in the State of the Union coming up, or are the priorities that will be set for the next 4 years?
Well, I think that he really did preview the State of the Union today. He's going to be talking about immigration, guns, energy, and what we might call the fiscal grand bargain. You know, entitlements, tax reform, what to do about putting our nation's fiscal problems on the correct path. I think that's what he's going to go through. You heard him talk about them today, and he's going to go into much more detail on February 12th.
All right. In our studio tonight, Mara Liasson, Don Gagne, Ron Elving, and Nina Totenberg. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
The show was produced by Giselle Grayson, directed by Monica Estatieva. Sean Phillips was the technical director. I'm Jennifer Ludden. This has been special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration. And Michelle Obama, no, that's not her. We thought it was a red dress. Still waiting for the inaugural ball. The limits of live radio. Special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration from NPR News.